So, as you know, I'm going away, but I want to say, as regards the podcast, I've got a clear plan. I'm going to be taking bold action, and we've got a secure future. And I think that's what the listeners need to know. So if we can try and fit those key buzzwords into this podcast, I think that's going to be very important. Because I've been going out listening to the listeners.
Have you?
Yes. Mm. Yeah. I've heard what they've had to say.
Well, that's great. Have you costed everything? That's the
everything,
question.
Yes. Everything is fully costed. Of course it
okay.
is.
Okay.
Yeah.
And my other question is, Joe, don't you think you've lost touch with the listeners? You know, you're not from where they are.
No, that's not true. Listen, and I don't want you to get, you know, emotional because we've just got to record a podcast. But I mean, just between you and me, you know, I come from very humble beginnings. And, well, you know this, you know, growing up, I was denied Sky TV. I know, I'm sorry.
I don't know. I've got to take time to process that now.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 289. That's a lot, isn't it?
It does seem way too much to me.
Worryingly near 300. Anyway, 289 of the Mid-Faith Crisis podcast. My name is Nick Page, and there is Man of the People.
Yes,
Joe Davis.
I know. Humble, humble beginnings. But up from the ashes.
You've risen from very humble beginnings to very humble present, actually.
Don't you love politicians? It's great.
Do you know what? That interview, so for our overseas listeners, you know, this was an interview with our Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, where the interviewer pointed out that he was actually technically richer than the king. I think that's
yeah.
true. I just wonder when at what point is he going to realise, hang on, I'm richer than the king. I don't have to do this.
Yeah, I think so. What is he going to do with all the money and deals he's doing? I know.
At some point you think he's going, oh, hold on, that's true. I don't have to do any of this. Oh, I'm off. I'm See, going.
I think Elon Musk just gave himself a pay rise of sort of like, I don't know, 500 yeah. million or something. I mean, you couldn't live on it, but, you know.
Yeah, it's a struggle to get by. Anyway, yes, so just the church notices that about this literary festival that I'm doing on June the 22nd, and you can find all the links for that in the show notes.
Yes, and there seems to be quite a lot of love for you on our Facebook page.
Well, that's great.
And indeed the book, The Nearly Infallible History of Christianity, by Nick Page, still available on all good booksellers.
I wrote it a long time ago. I can't remember a flipping word. So should be a short interview. But anyway, yeah, love to see people there. It'd be great. So how are you?
Oh, well, yeah, thank you. Well, it would be true to say I'm going on holiday tomorrow.
So. Oh, really?
So that's great.
Come as a complete shock to me.
I am on my knees. So that is that's a really good thing. Hey, had a great time with Mick and Mario. Thank you for coming over from the Netherlands. And they stayed the night with us. And that was a beautiful thing. And they bought me cheese.
Of course they did. It's the price. It's the price that anyone must pay.
I didn't expect it, but what a lovely gift. I mean, cheese is just beautiful, isn't it? So there we go. I suppose it's fair to say on Sunday I will have been married 40 years to Rachel.
Good Lord.
I know. I don't even feel 40 years old, so I don't really know how I could be married for 40 years. But, you know, we've checked the figures and that is, in fact, correct. So that's great. And it's, you know, it's been tough. We've been through some tough times because unlike our Prime Minister and his wife, Rachel, she has many strong qualities, but she doesn't have 600 million in the bank.
No, I've noticed that. And I often wonder why we're still friends, to be honest.
It would have made quite a difference. but good times. She says she likes me. So I'll take that. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it is great. And yeah. So there we are. I'm very grateful for that and grateful for her. So yeah, that's probably it for now, really. I don't think I have much else to say. I'm sure there are other things, but that's the big headline news. How are you?
I'm good, actually. I'm all right. Yeah, not bad. Yeah. So as I mentioned last week, went to the theatre on Thursday last week, and the play was okay. It was all right. But what was odd was we went to a matinee on the Thursday.
Yeah.
And it was the over 60s matinee.
Oh.
And I felt sort of, I've crossed the bridge now.
Yeah.
You know, I've got the senior rail card.
Did you get a cup of tea and a biscuit?
Well, you know, they play bingo at the interval and it's all that. No, it was, you know, great. I'm all for discounts, yeah, for age. Sure. That's great. But it was odd to be amongst, I don't know, people, because I thought, I'm still working. Why am I here? But anyway, there we are. Going to see more theatre next week. Going to see Moby Dick.
Oh, right. Good. Yeah. Is there water?
I don't think there'll be actual water. I think they will use the magic of theatre.
Okay, good.
I imagine the same will be true of the whale. anyway.
Well, Moby Dick without a real whale is ridiculous.
Yeah, well, it's true. I'll ask for some money back. I did an interview on Premiere last week.
Did you?
I did an hour-long interview.
Oh, gosh.
About my faith journey.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And you could make that last an hour.
Yeah. It's not so much a journey, more a sort of long downhill decline. But no, it was good with a friend of mine called Chick Yule, who I haven't seen for a long time, used to be in the Salvation Army, a wonderful man, Chick.
Great.
And I don't know if it's available on sort of any kind of streaming or whatever, but if it is, I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah.
If people want to sort of send themselves to sleep, they can do that.
Mm.
That's pretty much me. Yeah.
Oh, great. Well, so we should move on because there's much to do. And you've got to be in your bonnet about Sabbath, haven't you? So
I want to talk about Sabbath because I don't know, we haven't really mentioned this very much, or you haven't really mentioned it very much. You are going on holiday.
I am taking a break.
You've kept it very quiet. I should say at this point, having raised it, that means for the next couple of weeks, the episode after this one, the episodes will come out every 2 weeks for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
A couple of episodes. So, you know, that gives us both a break and indeed gives you, the listener, a good break from us.
Which you need.
Yes, which you certainly need. So I'm going to talk about Sabbath a bit. In a little while, but we'll have some feedback first, I guess.
Yes, let's. Okay. Well, I'm just including this one. I know you don't like these kind of ones, but when people say nice things about us, I'll try and cut that. But no, but this is just great. This is from Mark. He says, "Dear Joe and Nick, I wanted to write and thank you for the podcast. Earlier this year, my wife, having read through the Bible in a year a couple of times and confronting unpalatable bits that made her angry and uncomfortable, bought Nick's book, The Badly Behaved Bible. As a result of that, she also began to listen to your podcast, and then so did I. She is listening at a sensible pace while I was rapidly obsessed and have recently completed a romp through all 288 episodes." Well, well done, Mark. He says, "Where were you for the last 20 years of my life? 20 years ago, I ended up throwing the baby out with the bathwater and heading for atheism, partly because I couldn't find anyone to talk to about concerns and doubts I was having. My journey away and back to faith has been long and painful, but these last few months I feel I've been able to do mid-faith crisis better second time round, retrospectively, thanks to your podcast and to Nick's book, which I've also just finished. I sense there will be interesting times ahead, being part of an Anglican church with a conservative evangelical vicar, but I feel peaceful in what I hope is the beginnings of living in the stage of faith Brian McLaren refers to as harmony. The overriding sense I have at this point is that I'm a beloved child of God. I want to concentrate on following Jesus, to love God's world and its people, who all bear something of his, her image, and to read the Bible, hoping to hear God in the midst of its complexities and contradictions, holding lightly to theology. Joy and gratitude well up in me over and over again at the love of God and the beauty and wonder of the world, and I long to do my bit with God's help to make the world a slightly better place, not a worse one. Thank you both for helping me along this road. Bless you." And that's from Mark.
That's lovely. Thank you very much indeed.
What a fabulous email. Yeah, thank you, Mark. That did our hearts good to read that. And yeah, this is, I suppose, why we do the podcast, really, just to say there is hope. There are other people like you out there, and you stick with us for as long as you want to.
Oh, thank you. That's great.
Also, you know, well done on doing 288 episodes. And I must just say a big shout out to Ken. Ken recently told me this week that he has trawled through all 288 episodes. I mean, that,
good grief.
Yes, I know.
I mean, I wouldn't.
No, who would? Well, Ken and Mark, for a start.
Some of the episodes I was present, but I wasn't really listening either. So, you know, I can't even claim to have done that.
Andy wrote in, a dear friend, Andy, just talking about the journey of faith over the last few years and asking us a question, which is, do we know of any stage four churches? So that's that harmony stage. Mm. And he says, do you see any signs of a tectonic shift in the UK churches?
Gosh.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, well, hello, Andy. I mean, isn't it funny? You meet people or you hear from people years later, and we've all been on a similar journey.
Yeah.
I think there is a shift, but I don't know if it's tectonic.
No.
I think that many leaders are sort of finding out that they have to change in a way. Some of the leaders are finding out they have to change. Many are finding out they want to change, and they want to change the way they lead and what they talk about. I think it will take quite a long time before we sort of have, as you might call, a lot of stage four churches. I don't know how you feel about it, but for me, the model of church is still changing, but not changing enough, I think.
Well, I suppose I have a more fundamental question, which is, can a church be a stage four church?
Yeah.
Can it actually be? Can all the people live at that harmony stage? I mean, I just think, going back to the stages and that sort of child development model and stuff, you know, when a babe needs milk and then it can have solids and all that sort of stuff, all the metaphors there. Can you have, you know, people in the stage of faith where they want to learn the rules and, you know, be part of the tribe with a clear boundaries and a strong sense of belonging? Can they really coexist with people like me in the church? I don't know, is the answer.
I mean, that is an extreme example.
Yes, it is an extreme, but mature Christians should always be able to love, include and embrace people, and that perhaps is a sign of their maturity. Whereas I think very often, with the best will in the world, in those earlier stages, you're more concerned with being right than loving. I don't know. That may be wrong.
Well, I do think the challenge we've had, and it's lovely to hear nice words about the podcast, as we heard before, but I think one of the challenges we've had, which we've never quite cracked, is, you know, mid-faith crisis communities or those kinds of things, those groups. And the reason we haven't cracked it is it's not only due to the complete inadequacy of the hosts in many ways, although I think that is a hugely contributing factor.
And it's taken as read,
Yeah. It's actually because it's, you know, I think these things have to happen organically at a local level, really. And it's quite hard, actually, to find your fellow soulmates about, you know, in this part of the journey, because a lot of the time you're emerging from churches that actually don't want anything to do with that.
Yes.
They're not going to enable it because they don't like it.
Yeah, for sure.
So I don't think we've ever quite cracked that. And if we had, we wouldn't be doing the podcast. We'd be running a cult, really, wouldn't we?
Yes, indeed. Happy times. I did for a while.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's just touch on it. I mean, this one could be the rest of the episode in itself, but let's just do this. This is from Chris, and he says, Hi, Joe and Nick. Bless you for helping keep us sane in a weird world. He said, I was just wondering what you've done with your demons, in inverted commas, in the mid-faith journey. I come from a mix of mild independent Methodist, then very unmild Pentecostal background, with two very different views of the supernatural and particularly spiritual warfare. In my journey, I've quite easily shooed out the demons, though evil is annoyingly still very much around, but I've still a lot of Christian friends who are perpetually locked in supernatural jujitsu with spirits. I'd be interested in your thoughts. Love the podcast. And that's from Chris.
Well, I mean, I think that is a whole episode, really, and we should probably plan ahead and do one. But I think I think what I would want to say is that I have tried to remain open to that spiritual side without being overwhelmed in the way that I was. Partly that's because of, you know, some of my work is with Christians from very different backgrounds and very different parts of the world, where these things are absolute reality to them.
Yes, and indeed, yeah.
Where the fight against principalities and powers is very real, and not only on the demonic, but it's against governments and authorities and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, that side of it I get, you know, that governments and the powers and the sort of corporate evil in that sense. The demons side and casting them out of people, not so much for me, I'm afraid.
No, but I think I think that maybe it's a viewpoint that you come to in a certain context, and it's a way of talking about the world, talking about what's going on, that operates in certain different societies and different contexts and has a real power there. I don't think we can deny that Jesus was known almost primarily as an exorcist. That's what he did.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And,
yeah.
And that was part of the power. So we have to come to terms with it. I think I need to think about it and talk about it, and maybe we can do a bit more of an episode on it. All I'd say is that I remember writing, when I was writing a book called The Wrong Messiah, which is sort of history of Jesus' life, I spoke to two people about the exorcism bits. Well, I spoke to lots of people, but there were two people, key people. One was my friend Steve, who was a psychiatrist, and he looked at them and said, basically, they all look like personality disorders, schizophrenia, those kinds of things. You know, that's, he said, an epilepsy. He said that's how we would class them, but that's how he felt. The other was a friend of mine, very, very wise man, who'd spent a lot of time working out in Africa and places like that, and he was absolutely convinced of the demonic. So I just think at the end of the day, you have to remain slightly open.
Yeah. I want to, although I have to say my journey is to becoming less and less open to it, I think. I mean, I remember going to a conference in Brighton. We've talked about it before, and, you know, demons are being cast out of everyone. And I did have the feeling with some people, you know, you poor dear soul, you just need someone to give you some attention and love and some friends.
Yeah.
And you probably need to see a therapist for this thing you're having cast out of you, because, you know, this is not... I just don't think it works like that. Just come and have a demon cast out of you, and you're fine. So, and I also wonder, and this is, you know, we will discuss it more. You know, if you're in a culture where you're told this is how the work is, there's a God up there and there's demons down below, and these demons, if you let them in, they can run havoc with your life. Well, if you grow up truly believing that is the way reality is, then, yeah, there's definitely room for someone to come along and say, let me cast out your demons.
Yeah,
you know, I definitely think that. And that's perhaps part of the problem that the church is facing. You know, we're confronting old worldviews with the new emerging worldview. And it's, how do you make sense of, you know, the Bible that was written 2,000 years ago, speaking to an old worldview? How do you now extrapolate all its wisdom and values into the new worldview? And it's difficult at times because... you know, what is reality, I suppose. So we'll discuss that more.
Yeah, and I think what I would want to say to that, and the question I need to grapple with, is it purely an old world view? In other words, can we entirely just remove that view, or does it still have validity and power in our... Is there something we're missing here? In our, if we over rationalize it, just as I think there's a lot we're missing if we just go for it gung ho, you know.
And, no, I agree. Anyway. And you know, certainly when it comes to institutional evil, how do you describe that personality and power that institutions have that is somehow greater than the people that make them up? You know, what language can you give? I still don't think we have language to describe it. Maybe we'd say the ethos of an organisation. We don't have words to describe that sometimes there is a personality and it's decidedly evil.
Yes.
You know, it's decidedly mean and selfish and self-serving. And yeah, okay. So there's more work to be done.
We'll come back to that.
Yes, but thank you, Chris, so much for writing in with a good question. So that, I think, we're going to leave the feedback there. And I should say that over the next few weeks, you won't be getting replies to feedback. Please do feel free to send stuff in, but don't expect too much in the way of replies, because I don't know whether I've mentioned this, but I won't be here.
And also, I don't reply to emails. And that's the other thing.
Exactly.
You know, in any proper organisation, somebody would pick up the slack, but that is not going to happen. So listen, I put this down as an idea to talk about. I wanted to talk about it. Because I had the wonderful experience the other day of being in church and hearing a really great sermon that changed the way I view things.
Mm, brilliant.
And so, again, talking about not giving up on things, that's quite good. And I suppose it fits in with our discussions that we've been having recently around what you're doing and around the nature of church and, indeed, the nature of nature churching. You see what I did there? Thank you. So, I mean, I want to just talk about the whole idea of Sabbath and what I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
But I suppose the question is, what does it mean to you in the first place, really? What does it still have a relevance for you?
Yes, very much so. You know, the idea that one day a week is spent in pleasure and rest and restoring my soul has become more important, not less important, I think. And then we joke about, you know, my Sabbath ritual. Do you know about my Sabbath ritual? Have I told you?
No. Well, I mean, you might have, but I probably wasn't listening.
My Sabbath ritual is on a Friday night. Is I always, like, after work, I have to have a bath, a drink, and I read The Week. Which is a magazine. It's like a magazine of a summary of all the week's news, but it's got lots of great bits in it and everything. And I have done that for, I don't know, the last 20 years, probably.
Oh. Well, I'm glad to hear you have a bath. I mean, that's...
Hey, it's good to know I have a bath every week, isn't it? Because I think it's important to wash weekly. But there's just something, I'm not joking, I do have to wash the week away, you know, the stress. So I do see it as a very symbolic act, actually, a sacramental act of just letting that week go. And hey, now it's the weekend and there's a transition point here. And if for any reason I can't do it on a Friday, I genuinely miss it. I fret about it because I just feel like, oh, the week is still sticking to me a little bit and I want to wash it off. Mm. So you make of that what you will, Dr. Freud. It's probably ridiculous, but that's what I do.
No, I think that is very much a part of the whole philosophy behind the original sort of Sabbath. As part of sort of planning for this, bringing out of the sermon, I read another book by a Jewish scholar called Abraham Heschel, I'd not come across before. And he wrote a book on the Sabbath, and he starts out by pointing out that the Sabbath was the first holy thing in the cosmos, the first thing called holy.
Right.
You should keep the day holy, but there was before there was any holy place. You know, there's no sacred places. There's a sacred time.
Yeah.
And he contrasts the whole idea of Sabbath between the idea of time and space. And so we spend most of our time trying to conquer space, things, you know, whereas Sabbath is about time and it's about escaping the world of things.
Oh, wow. I love that.
Yeah, it's an absolutely brilliant book. I'll put a link in. But anyway, I think that idea of sort of washing off the week, or that kind of idea of the rest at the end of the week, is the very strong way that we think about the Sabbath. Well, we think about it in terms of the Friday night, the Saturday, or the Sunday.
Mm.
What happened in this sermon was that my friend Jeff, who was preaching, was sort of recalibrating or taking us back to the early church. And he began by talking about a visit that happened by Rowan Williams, because Jeff used to teach at a theological college where my wife also taught for a bit. And Rowan Williams came when he was Archbishop, and then there was a time for questions. And somebody asked him this question, which I think is a brilliant question, which is, when you take communion, what are you thinking about?
Wow.
I mean, most of us, I don't know what you know, I'd be thinking about all kinds of things. But Rowan Williams being...
Yeah.
The sort of prophet and poet that he is, he said what he was thinking about was the end of everything, was the time when we would be gathered in to Christ, as he called it, as he termed it.
Okay.
And that how communion was a prefigurement of that, that I suppose you'd call it a messianic banquet or whatever you want to call it, that actually it's a kind of taste of the end, taste of where we're going, taste of the ultimate, which in itself is a fascinating kind of answer, isn't it? I mean,
well it is. There'd be a lot of supplementary questions, I think.
There would. Anyway, to come back to the sermon, what Jeff then talked about was that Sabbath is part of a taste of the future. It's to do with the future as much about the past.
Okay, yeah.
And he posed this question to us, which again made me completely rethink. He said, what day do you think of as the start of the week? And I mean, don't know what you think. How do you think about that? What's your start of the week?
Generally, I do think of it as Monday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think of it as Monday.
I mean, we all know it's Sunday, or culturally, it's been Sunday.
Yeah.
Because Sunday is the first day of the week, and that's our Christian background. But effectively,
we
all think of it as Monday, don't we?
I'm going back to work Monday, you know, and that's it. Yeah.
But what the sermon made me realize was how big a step the early church had taken by moving their Sabbath to the Sunday.
Okay.
Because they moved it from the end of the week to the beginning of the week, from the seventh day to the first day.
Okay.
Because they were still operating in a Jewish sort of structure. You know, we know they did this very early because it's mentioned in Acts. So we know that it's very early on that they did this. And that's a huge change, actually.
Yes, it is, yeah.
It's a massive change. And the sort of thing that we take from that is obviously they did it because that was the day of resurrection. That was the day Jesus returned. So it's to do with that. But if we viewed the Sabbath instead as the beginning of the week rather than the end of the week, it's not so much recharging as charging. It becomes a way of sort of energising ourselves for the future rather than just, we've made it to the end of the week.
Rather than recovering,
For me, I just found that incredibly exciting, interesting, because it sort of injects this positivity into the thing. One of the problems I've always had with Sabbath, the way we've done it in the church, Sabbatarianism kind of stuff, is that it becomes so dutiful and obligatory and about, you know, we're just washing off, as you know, sloughing off the week, and we're sort of recovering. We've made it. We miss out on one of the central things of the Sabbath, which is actually Heschel talks about in his book a lot, which is joy.
Yeah.
The idea that actually it should be a day of joy. And you sort of touched on that when you were thinking about it as something joyful.
Yeah.
I think one of the worst things we've done in church is to suck all the joy out of the Sabbath.
Yeah, for sure.
And to turn it into an obligation. I mean, how did you think about it when you were a minister?
Well, I suppose I thought everyone else is having Sabbath except me because I've got work.
Yeah.
I've generally got to work quite hard, and I'm going to feel very tired at the end of the day and worn out, if I'm honest. I mean, that said, I enjoyed it because I'm a people person and I was with lots and lots of people. So, you know, there's a plus side to it as well. But I never saw it as a particularly relaxing day.
I don't know how many of us would genuinely say, you know, our Sunday is a day of joy. Mm. We say Sunday is the day of rest.
Yeah.
But I don't think we would necessarily say that. Not least because, as I said, sometimes you end up going to places which leave you feeling very unjoyful,
exactly.
which you literally do not enjoy. But we've got an interview coming up with Dave Tomlinson next episode, which is really interesting. One of the things he talks about is hope as defiant imagination, which I think is a great idea. But I'd like to see, what can we think about Sabbath as defiant joy? Because the world needs joy.
It needs to have it
re-injected. And the idea that actually this is a joyful start to the week. It's a kind of, we kick off the week with joy and hope and love and worship and all this stuff. You know, instead of it, we got to the end of it and we can now just sink down. I suppose the danger here is that if seeing the Sabbath as the start of this week as something that energizes us to go out. You there's a danger that you sort of fall back in that old thing about, you know, well, we go to church in order to get charged up to go out and evangelize and change the world, and it becomes all very dutiful. And that, you know, that is true. We are supposed to change the world. What does that lovely first email say? You know, I just want to,
that's,
you know,
brilliant. The end of it,
do my bit. I just want to do my bit to make the world a little bit better. Yeah. So that is a calling on us.
Yeah.
But I actually don't think it's about that. I think it's about helping us to go out and see the world properly, see it in all its beauty and its pain.
That's a lovely thought. How do you think? So are you saying the early church, they intentionally moved it and from the end of the week to the start of the week, but they intentionally made it a day of joy? Is that what you're
saying? I think the Jewish tradition was that it should be a day of joy.
Right.
Heschel talks about Sabbath as their cathedral. You know, they didn't have buildings, they had the temple, but after that was destroyed, they didn't have anything. So they didn't have, they had a cathedral of time, a place where, and a lot of the rabbinic writing is all about the joy of the Sabbath, the treasure that it is, this wonderful thing. I'm not sure the early church invented that idea, but they probably took some of that on. After all, it's the resurrection day.
Okay. I mean, maybe you want to say more, and maybe I want to move us too quickly to my question is, what does this mean for us? Because I think Sabbath's much harder now. Certainly when I was a lad, you know, all the shops were closed. You know, nothing was really open on a Sunday. There weren't, you know, kids didn't have football or anything like that. And so I suppose everyone understood that Sunday was a different day in the week. Everyone understood, culturally, society understood. Not that Sabbath was holy. I don't think it understood that. But they knew that Sunday was different. It's a day when you rest, or you, if you're a churchgoer, which a lot more people were, then you go to church on a Sunday and, you know, all those sort of things. That was the culture. Now we live in a kind of 24/7, you know, all the days kind of merge into one.
Yeah.
Many people are working on a Sunday now. Is it too early to move us to what does Sabbath mean for people who work 5 days a week and people who work 6 days a week and, you know, all those sort of things? My head is spinning.
I think that Sabbath was defined when I was young by lots of don'ts. It was a very negative day,
actually. Yes, it was,
I can't say it was a joyful day.
No. Very religious.
Every other Sunday, we went to my grandmother's for lunch, and that was not a joyful thing, her lunch. It was you could cut her gravy with a knife. It was rather dour, wasn't it? There was nothing on, and you couldn't really do anything. And I do think, however, there's the flip side of that, which now it's no different, and we haven't escaped the world of things at all. We use our Sabbath as a way of gaining more things, and sometimes we have deliveries on that day. And I think there's a case for us to kind of think about other people, and see what their lives are like on the Sabbath, and do we really need that? Do we really need to make them come and deliver something to us that day? Do we, you know, I know it's all complicated, but so I think there's this sort of negativity of it. We need to put the positivity back.
Okay.
Having said that, I also think it's about energizing us to see the world properly. I read this great quote again from Rowan Williams this week, and it sort of touched me, because we were talking last week about your experience about mysticism. You know, I was saying that maybe what you're experiencing out at NEP.
Mm.
And incidentally, should we not be getting sponsorship from NEP? Because you are sort of mentioning them every episode.
Yes,
you
know, you,
I feel like we should be getting some money for this. But your experience of that is mysticism. But there's this great quote from Rowan Williams. I'd just like to read it. He says, a lot of talk about mysticism and spirituality can be heard as giving you an escape route. Life is difficult, but let's take our glasses off so things look a bit more vague. But the proper definition of mysticism means we can see the nature of suffering more clearly, not less. It doesn't make it easier, it makes it clearer. Any idea of mental health or spiritual fulfillment that suggests the point of it all is to make it easier becomes really a way of seeing less than there is to see. I hope that our growth is towards seeing suffering more clearly and feeling some of the ache and the wound of it, while not being driven into a reactive, over-busy, over-anxious response.
Well, that's different.
Yeah. Now, and I think that's a real challenge. And it, obviously, that comes from a talk where he's talking about mental health. So he's obviously talking about the suffering. Mid-faith crisis, for example, I don't think the goal can be to escape in that way.
No.
A lot of us come to it because we have been imprisoned by a certain type of ecclesiology or a certain type of doctrine, or even in some cases, sadly, abusive churches. So a lot of us come to it from that. But, you know, as you've always made clear, the stages of faith are not about escape. No. They are about engagement at a deeper and more intentional and different level. More fulfilling, more wholesome, yeah. And dare I say, more joyful level.
Yeah.
So I think Sabbath comes into that, because it's not about this thing about, let's get out of the week, let's get out of this thing, let's get away from that. It's about helping us to bring joy into our lives, to bring hope into our lives, but actually also to see things properly without being overwhelmed by them, really.
Yeah. Okay, I like it. I'm thinking of the original context of slaves in Egypt and being released, and then, you know, wanting to live like slaves again, and going, no, come on, this is a really important commandment to stop being slaves. And I suppose, you know, one of the questions I always think are, in what ways are we enslaved in our own lives, but also who are the modern slaves, and, you know, all those kind of questions. So do you, I mean, coming out of all this stuff, and it sounds like you've really thought about it a lot, what's your top tips for engaging with Sabbath? Well, you know, post mid-faith crisis or during mid-faith crisis or whatever it is, do you have any ideas on what it looks like for us to really, you know, embrace Sabbath now?
Well, I mean, I'm not doing it properly. I think that's one of the things that's the challenge for me, that I need to focus back onto it and to really think what it looks like for me. So I would think, firstly,
have a bath.
Yeah. Firstly, have a bath and read the week.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
Have a beer or a glass of wine.
Exactly.
Well, do something joyful. You know, I mean, that would be it. Do something joyful. I think spend time with God, however you do that.
Yeah, whatever that means for you.
But
yeah.
Also recognizing that if you said to yourself, well, the week starts here, the week begins here.
Yeah, that's different. That's very different. Yeah.
Then maybe that changes things for us. And I think actually, Joe, the reason I want to talk about this episode was because as you've kept so quiet, you are going on holiday. But of course, holidays come from holy days, saints' days. They are festivals, religious festivals. That's how they work. And I think the question for you is also, you know, your holiday is now a well-deserved break at the end of a very hard period for you. But in what ways is it also a preparation? In what ways is it going to be the start of something?
Yeah.
That's the question. I mean, and I don't mean the start of a marathon drinking session or the marathon cheese session, as I suspect it may be. But, you know, that's the thing. I suppose the challenge for me is I'm trying to think, and I'm sorry I've talked such a lot, but it's really on my mind.
I can see it's really, you're passionate about this stuff.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting and I need to think more about it. But I think the challenge for me is, can I at least start the week in a totally different way? At a totally different time.
Yes.
And not see it as the sort of end of things, but actually see it as a prefigurement of the real end of things, where we're gathered into Christ. I think that's a real challenge.
I like that. And this is, for me, this is the takeaway from our conversation today. Absolutely. So I'm not going to be thinking about, like, well, it's still Sunday, let's face it, as the end of the week so much as it really is the start of the week. You start with rest and you start with joy and you start and that's the basis that you build the rest of the week on. I think that's a really that's a nice thought. I like that.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you for indulging me.
No,
it's my thoughts about that,
always fascinating.
I'd be really happy to hear from people, so if you have thoughts on this or indeed anything else that you know, if you want to talk about, do send us an email. And where do they send their emails to, Joe?
They would send it to joe@midfaithcrisis.org. But they would not expect a prompt reply to it. Although, to be honest, it's so easy just to look at it and go, oh, yeah, that's really interesting. So you might get a reply that goes, thanks, that's really interesting.
Anyway, the thing is, thank you very much for listening. Yeah. And thank you to those who support the podcast. If you'd like to do that, you can do that at the website. That's great. And we will be back with you in 2 weeks' time with an interview with Dave Tomlinson.
We will. And bless you all, and thank you for all your lovely emails. They mean so much to us. Thank you.